On this week's prequel episode, we follow up on our Sleeping Beauty listener polls and preview Maze Runner: The Death Cure. Hello and welcome back to another prequel episode of This Film Is Lit, the podcast where we talk about movies that are based on books. It's our final Summer Series 2025 prequel. So we're going to be previewing Death Runner. Before we get to that, we'll be seeing what everybody had to say.
Death Runner.
Death Runner. The Death
That's
Cure.
That's a way better name, Death honestly.
Runner. Yeah. The Death Cure. But before we get to that, we have Sleeping Beauty. And before we get to that, we have our patron shoutouts.
I put up with you because your father and mother were our finest patrons. That's why.
No new patrons this week, but we do have our Academy Award winning patrons, and they are Nicole Goble, Harpo Rat, Team Blue Dress, Vic Apocalypse, Matilde, Cottonwood Steve, Teresa Schwartz, Ian from Wine Country, Kelly Napier, Gratch, Just Gratch, Shelby Says No One Mourns the Wicked, That Darn Skag, and V Frank. Thank you all very much for your continued support. Shelby, great name. Great play on words there. It's for those who are only listening. Shelby's name is spelled WCKD from the Maze Runner series. And for people who don't know the reference, if you haven't seen Wicked, that is the opening number. Not the opening number, but one of the numbers in Wicked. No One Mourns the Wicked. So very clever. And also, Nathan up there.
Team Blue Dress. Because Blue Dress is superior.
There you go. Katniss is the one being a problem. We have the cats in the studio for the first time, like, ever, just to see how it's going to go. Yeah.
So if you hear little meows meeps
in the background, that's just Grindy or Katniss. Yeah. But I assumed Grindy would be the problem, but Katniss is over here
trying to tear our carpet apart.
So we'll see how this goes. Thank you all again for your continued support. Really appreciate it. Katie, it's time to see what people had to say about Sleeping Beauty.
Yeah, well, you know, that's just like... your opinion, man.
All right. On Patreon, we had one vote for the book and five for the movie. Kelly Napier said, I'm so glad someone else thought of the textile workers when all the spinning wheels were destroyed. This has haunted my thoughts since childhood.
Yeah.
I would love to see a spinoff of the tale where we follow one of the people in the kingdom whose livelihood is just obliterated by the king and queen. Prince Philip is 4 at the christening, so he's 20 and she's 16 when the bulk of the movie happens.
There you go.
So, yep, gross.
Called it.
I'd like to take a minute, if you'll indulge me, to do my own little spinoff. Welcome to This Film is Ballet. It's disclosed in the title credits that the score is based on the Tchaikovsky ballet, The Sleeping Beauty, and the story of both the ballet and the movie follow pretty closely as well. Tchaikovsky based his ballet on the Grimm's story, but cut the number of fairies down to 6, with the focus being on the most powerful good fairy and the evil fairy. Interestingly, the evil fairy tears the wig off the master of ceremonies who failed to invite her to the christening and beats him with it before cursing the child.
Sweet.
She lives in the castle until her 16th birthday and is then presented with a number of suitors vying for her hand. During the dance with the suitors, a mysterious cloaked figure appears, presenting her with a gift, which is the spindle that pricks her.
This sounds like the Nutcracker. Isn't that like the Nutcracker?
I mean, Tchaikovsky also wrote the Nutcracker, I know. So like, fair enough.
But I'm just thinking about the part where like they all dance and then the guy gives her the Nutcracker.
Yeah.
Just kind of, yeah.
The entire kingdom is also put to sleep to wait out the 100 years with the princess. 100 years later, a prince hand-selected by the main good fairy is chosen to awaken the princess. The good fairy and prince work together to defeat the evil fairy, the prince kisses the princess, and awakens the kingdom. The ballet concludes with the marriage of the prince and princess, blessed by the good fairy. And get this, the marriage ceremony is attended by Puss in Boots, Cinderella, Prince Charming, and Little Red Riding Hood, wow, among other fairy tale characters.
Fairy tale cinematic universe going on in this ballet.
Yeah, right? It's almost like an episode of Once Upon a Time.
Yeah. Or Shrek.
Or Shrek, yeah. Yeah. Tchaikovsky only composed 3 ballets, Swan Lake, Sleeping Beauty, and The Nutcracker. That's a solid 100% success rate right there.
They are all classics.
Yeah. I mean, if you ask anybody just off the street to name a ballet,
they're naming
one of these three.
I would argue even one of the two, Swan Lake or the Nutcracker.
Probably,
not that
Sleeping
Beauty isn't, but like I don't think it's as popular as
the Nutcracker
or Swan Lake. Katniss.
Katniss. Stop it. If you get a chance, listen to the suite from the ballet. The entire ballet is over 3 hours long, and the suite, which includes just the most recognizable pieces, clocks in at a much more consumable length. It's beautiful, and you'll definitely recognize some of it from how they used it in the movie. I thought it was a good decision by Disney to use a well-known piece of classical rep as a thread to tie all the properties together. Do not jump on this table.
We just got back from the movie. The reason we're letting the cats in here is I felt bad putting them right back into the bedroom. We've been gone all day at work.
Yeah.
And then we went to a movie straight after work. We saw the new Superman. It's good. You should see it. And so I felt bad like immediately shunting them into the bedroom when we got home. So we're trying it out, but we'll see how it goes.
I have a little side note, actually.
Yeah.
We went to see Sleeping Beauty, the ballet.
Oh, that's right. We did,
like,
yes.
Very early in our
relationship. No, I remember that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we left at intermission because I was the one who wanted to see it,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't know it was, like, 4 hours
long.
It was
very long, yeah.
And I didn't know you well enough to gauge how you were going to feel about that.
Yeah.
So I was at intermission. I was like, we can leave.
I do remember going to that. I don't remember, like, how I felt about it. I don't remember if I liked it or
that
not.
Was like very, very early
yes,
in our relationship.
Yeah,
I think it was
yeah.
before we lived together even.
Could be, yeah.
Anyway, back to Kelly's comment. Sorry for the long aside. I'll cast my vote and get out of the way now. I'm picking the story, but only the first part. The second part that was clearly added on at some point is just weird. The movie was a staple from my childhood, but I think the scales tipped in the story's favor because of how it's endured. One story from the oral tradition has withstood the test of time and transformed into at least two classic fairy tales, an iconic ballet, a beloved movie, and probably many more adaptations in whole or in part. That legacy can't be ignored, so my vote goes for the story.
Fair enough. I mean, it is hard to argue with...
It is hard to argue
the
with
enduring...
centuries of
yeah.
oral tradition
yeah.
and the enduring longevity of
yes.
narratives. Our next comment was from Charlene, who said, I didn't watch this one much as a kid, but it's actually the classic princess I've seen most recently. We watched it with our kids within the last year or so. I thought I remembered a line about the fairies wanting to put everyone else to sleep so they wouldn't be heartbroken over immediately losing the princess again. But it does come across as more of a cover your ass move than altruistic.
There probably is a line about that, if I had to guess.
Well, I feel like based on what she says, I do think that like they don't want everyone to be brokenhearted is what we're supposed to get from that scene. But like the way she says it
yes.
and the way it comes off definitely comes off as more of like,
yeah,
we're just gonna hide our mistake. Thank you, Kelly. I knew Once Upon a Dream was based on a ballet, but couldn't remember by whom. Mainly, I remember it from my oral skills class when I was a music major back in the day. One of the things we were tested on was hearing a melody and being able to write it out in music notes.
Hmm.
That sounds really hard. I don't know if I would want to do that.
That'd be tough, yeah.
I also don't really read music,
so. Well, then it would be very hard for you.
One day, this started playing, and I was thrilled it was something I knew, since remembering the melody between playings was usually harder than figuring out the notes, only to be completely thrown off by the key change, which we were, of course, familiar with as a concept, but hadn't gotten to this point covered in dictation. But anyway, back to the movie. It's gorgeous and iconic, and I chose it mainly because of that, and also because it inspired one of my favorite moments from Enchanted. And Brian, if you've watched that, we did do a bonus episode.
We did a bonus episode.
A
yeah,
ago.
Charlene, if
yeah.
you haven't seen, if you haven't listened, we have a bonus episode about Enchanted that we did during the Cinderella.
Mm.
When did we do that? Was it not correlated to a.
No, it wasn't correlated to anything.
Oh, I thought it was for some reason.
We did it a while ago, but
yeah.
we did cover it.
Yep.
And Brian, if you've watched that, it probably doesn't help in conflating Sleeping Beauty with Snow White. Giselle has a bit of all of the princesses in her, but the Evil Queen is primarily a mashup of those two villains.
I think another thing that doesn't help is Once Upon a Time.
That's also true.
All those characters get mixed up in my head because there's so much like twisty, turny soap and opera lore.
Everybody is everybody's daughter.
Everybody's related to everybody. So I just, I think that was honestly the thing that makes it even more confusing.
Katniss. Our next comment was from Ian from Wine Country, who said, "Well, sweet shit. Yes, the book." Having read all the Grimm's fairy books, as well as the pink fairy book, green fairy book, blue fairy book, etc., that were available as a child, and I bought the remaining colors on eBay as an adult.
I didn't know that was a thing. Grimm's stuff is split up into
the
different...
color fairy books are, they're associated with somebody else whose name I can't remember. But yeah, that's a, there was like a series of like fairy story books that were all named like different color fairies.
So these are not related to the Grimm's.
I don't
because now that I'm reading it, he says, having read all of Grimm's fairy books as well as the pink fairy. So those sound like at first I misread that and thought they were related somehow, but
Andrew Lang.
Okay.
Andrew Lang is the fairy book guy.
When is he from?
That was published between 1889 and 1913. Okay. Etc. that were available as a child, and I bought the remaining colors on eBay as an adult. Every single story was meant to have a lesson. They all taught something. Yes, that's very Victorian.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly, the princess gets cursed because her parents were too proud. Story was meant to be a warning for parents. They always had a lesson that was blatant. The movie doesn't really tell that lesson. Pretty sure Walt didn't read the stories.
I mean, I don't know if he did specifically.
Somebody did.
But somebody who
somebody wrote, did. I don't know if
he also didn't
did.
Write the screen. Yeah. He wasn't a credited writer on the movie. So
I feel like he just strolled in and said, I want to cover this.
Yeah. Well, and then he would stroll in and be like this, love that, hate that, hate that, hate that. Yeah.
I do. I feel so confident that that's the kind of guy Walt Disney was.
100%. 100%.
Our next comment on Patreon was from Shelby Says No One Mourns the Wicked. And Shelby said, this is one of those Disney movies I didn't grow up watching. I've said before, I didn't care for the princess ones as a kid, so it wasn't a priority. I saw it once when I was 15, mainly because I wanted to meet Maleficent. Who doesn't? Other than that, it didn't leave an impression. Watching it again, there's some beautiful animation here, and Once Upon a Dream is a lovely song, so I'll give it to the movie. Other thoughts? Why isn't the dress purple? The pink versus blue thing is fun, but when the spells hit the dress at the same time, I fully expected it to be purple by the end. That's what you get when you blend pink and blue. Is purple another princess's color? Actually, no.
I would argue, doesn't... No, because it's not... I was going to say, Jasmine's been... I wouldn't be at this time, obviously,
right.
But... ultimately, isn't Jasmine's costume like
her,
a lavendery?
Her fancy dress is like a purpley color.
Yeah. That's the only one I was thinking
of. I don't know. I can only assume that the animators were just having fun, and thought it was more fun to make it like a mishmash splash looking thing.
Yeah.
I was to combine them.
Yeah, it is interesting that they never decided, well, the obvious solution is purple. My only guess is that they tried purple and nobody liked purple. So they, you know what I mean? Like they probably tried that and then they were like, nah, nobody liked it. So they
is purple another princess's color? Ariel's perhaps. I feel like it would stand out nicely next to the rest of the princess lineup. It's like they set up the joke, but forgot the punchline. We're digging into a whole bag of worms here with princess dress colors because I think they did try purple on Ariel for a while and it never stuck.
Okay.
Sorry, Katie. The meet cute between Aurora and Philip put my back up like an angry cat in record time. No thank you to all of that. Go away. They felt like a missing couple out of A Midsummer Night's Dream. It is kind of a Midsummer Night's Dream-ish scene. That's fair. I'd forgotten that the three fairies are the real main characters in the movie. By the end, I was kind of wondering why Philip was there, to be honest. Somebody has to kiss her.
Yeah,
somebody's
got
to kiss her. I never understood why Maleficent needed to do anything after she cursed Aurora. She cast the spell. Shouldn't the magic take care of the rest? Is this a faulty spell? Why wouldn't it just conjure a spinning wheel out of nothing like Maleficent does in the movie? I understand the other characters trying to fight it anyway. I understand Maleficent working to stop them from breaking it. Why does she still have to make it happen? She didn't threaten to cast it before Aurora 16. She did cast it. It's already done.
I get what you're saying. And within the universe of the movie, I think that's fair because we see the other fairies just do like straight up magic.
Yeah.
When I read this comic the other day, my first thought was the reason she still has to do something is because it almost felt like they're playing on a, which again, within the universe of the movie doesn't make a lot of sense because the other fairies just point their wand at stuff and magic happens.
Mm-hmm.
But like kind of that like folkloric version of magic where casting a spell is less to do with like creating a magical outcome and more to do with like intention setting almost, if that makes sense. Like,
yeah,
that's kind of how I interpret it, of like she still needs to make sure it happens because that's how magic, again, if you ignore the other fairies' magic, that's like one way magic can work is like by, I don't even know how to describe it. Sorry, what were you going to say about it before you, were you going to, did you have?
No, I wasn't going to add anything.
Yeah, I don't know. Because obviously you would assume that the point of the spell is that it just happens.
I guess after 16 years, maybe she's just so fed up with the whole thing that she's made it like a personal vendetta now.
To
see it through to the end and make sure that it happens.
I guess. But yeah, you would assume that like it just would happen without her help. But I don't know. It's an interesting question. Because I did think about that. And I was like, why does she have to show up and like do it for her? Like, isn't that the point of the curse?
But she's a very involved CEO of evil.
Yeah.
She's hands on. Shelby's last comment here was, some of the music and animation reminded me of Lady and the Tramp. I watched that one a lot as a kid.
You know what? Maybe I have to go back and look at the actual language of the curse, because the curse she gives in the movie, I think, does specifically say, like, before the sun sets on her 16th birthday, she will prick her finger on
the spindle of a spinning wheel.
And die or whatever. And I guess if there was, depending on how you necessarily interpret that, the idea could be if she pricks her finger on the spindle of a spinning wheel, she will suffer this curse and die.
Yes.
But that the curse itself is not ensuring that she will prick her finger on a spinning or a spindle. It's ensuring that if she does,
you know,
she will die.
I do like,
you know,
that
what I mean?
Interpretation, like, because that makes the attempts to avoid the curse make sense.
Make more sense.
Because
yeah.
if it's unavoidable, right, then why bother whisking her away to the woods for 16
yes.
years?
Yeah. Yeah.
If it's going to happen no matter what.
I guess you're
going
to try, but yeah. Yeah. So that might be the reason. Again, I guess it kind of comes up to your interpretation, because the curse in the movie, I'm pretty sure, explicitly says, like, she will prick her finger. Like, it almost implies that it is a foregone conclusion that this will happen. But I guess you could kind of mess with that interpretation and say, like, I don't know. I would have to listen to the exact wording in the movie. But, like, if it's more to do with if she pricks her finger, she will die or fall into a slumber, I guess, once changed, then Maleficent showing up to like ensure that she pricks her finger on the spindle doesn't necessarily, or that still works, like, because it hasn't happened to this point, and so she's trying to make
and
it happen.
And to be fair, the curse doesn't stipulate that it has to happen on her 16th birthday.
No.
It could
no,
have
it
happened
by,
at any point throughout her whole childhood. So the fact that it hasn't yet, now we're running up against the deadline.
Right. Running up against the deadline. Again, I get what Shelby's saying, because I also interpreted, and I think the explicit text of what is said in the movie is that it will happen, like implying that this fate is set in stone and it won't take. It's not an if, it is a when it happens.
Right.
But I think if you play a little wiggle room in there and kind of interpret it more of like if she were to prick her finger, I don't know. Just a
but no, Lady and the Tramp, that's another one that I like. And also, I believe, animated in the 50s. So it makes sense that it would have some stylistic similarities to this one.
Oh, interesting. I haven't seen Lady and the Tramp since I was also probably the same age I watched this. So.
Lady and the Tramp has the scariest Disney villain, the rat that tries to bite the baby.
I truly don't remember. And I know I've seen it, I'm sure.
That's my Disney to villain hot take is that the rat is the scariest one. All right. Over on Facebook, we had 0 votes for the book and 2 for the movie. And we had 1 comment from Kat who said, I agree with Katie. This movie is visually stunning. And while it's certainly true that we spend no time learning why or how Aurora and Philip fall in love, that's not the point. And if your only criticism of the movie is shitting on the anti-feminist point of her being saved, I think you're missing all the historical context of the passed down fairy tale and the time the film was made, in addition to just regurgitating boring middle school level analysis.
I think it would be shitting on the... There's too many double negatives in there. Never mind. I don't know. The shitting on the anti-feminist point of her... never mind. My brain can't process... I agree with what you're saying. I get what you're saying and agree with it. Never mind.
It's not my favorite Disney film. The stunning visuals is the movie's strongest point, and it lacks the same comedy or musical punch of following films. But I also have a soft spot for Once Upon a Dream.
Just reread your sentence. It makes total sense. My brain didn't. Sorry. I put it together. My brain parsed it. Good job.
If we can suspend our disbelief and lovingly embrace fairy tale tropes like valiant heroes and evil for evil's sake, why can't we accept fated lovers or love at first sight?
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. It's like you just, again, if you have the context and you're able to understand within this type of story what's going on here.
Yeah.
It's fine.
It's genre conventions.
Yeah, exactly.
Over on Instagram, we had 2 votes for the book, 4 for the movie, and 1 listener who couldn't decide. Also, real quick, I just want to mention this. We don't get a ton of interaction on Threads, but also I can't get into our Threads account right now. I don't, they shut our Threads account down for suspicious activity, and I cannot figure out how to get back into it. So
if you're
following us on Threads, I'm sorry, I don't know what to do. But over on Goodreads, we had 0 votes for the book and 1 for the movie. And Miko said, nothing much to say about this one. I feel like we lose something when Aurora's sleep only lasts 1 night. I mean, a couple hours, I think. Not even a whole night.
Yeah, honestly.
However, I like Prince Philip meeting her before the curse more than him being some random guy. So it's an overall positive change. It was a bit weird when the 7 League boots were mentioned in Perrault's version, like a cameo from another tale.
7 League boots, those showed up in Ella Enchanted, right?
Maybe.
Aren't those the ones that, like, they put them on and you take a step and you move, and like, super far?
You move 7 leagues.
Yeah. They're also in, aren't they in,
They crop up in a lot of stuff.
Pratchett uses them in something, doesn't he? We Free Men, maybe? Do they show up?
Maybe.
I think they were in Ella Enchanted.
That makes, because the main thing that I know 7 League boots from is actually another Gail Carson Levine, who's the author of Ella Enchanted. She uses them in The Princesses of Bemare.
Maybe you mentioned them when we were talking about Ella Enchanted then, and maybe that's why my
brain connected them. Because I don't remember for sure if they were in Ella Enchanted.
Because I know I'd heard of them before, and for some reason my brain connected in Ella Enchanted, and the only way, if they weren't in that, the only way it would have happened would be you mentioning them from something else. So.
The fairy tales were fun to read, but the movie is better, as is the blue dress.
Another blue dress defender.
Team blue dress. Also, I expect the Death Ring references to continue for the whole Death Cure episode.
I'm glad somebody caught that every time I've been saying the Death Cure, I've been saying the Death Cure.
Like I don't know what that reference is.
It's a good, better, bad, bad reference. There's an early episode we did called the Death Ring.
I vaguely remember you covering that.
And during that, there's this one moment in the movie where the main character... they're talking about the Death Ring, and there's this very obviously 80-yard line where the main character goes, the Death Ring, and like the cadence of which how he says it every time I see the Death Cure, I can't help but say it in that cadence. So I'm glad somebody caught it.
Well, now we know Miko is a good Battered Yeah, Dad I didn't
actually
fan.
Know that Miko was a Junior Beauty fan. Yeah.
All right. Our winner this week was The Movie with 12 votes to the book's 3, plus our one listener who couldn't decide.
Sweet. Movie crushed it.
Really, truly.
Fantastic. Thank you all for your feedback. Really appreciate it. Katie, no learning thing segment this week because we've learned about Dashner in this series already, but we are going to preview The Death Cure, the book.
I can handle Thomas. He'll show up eventually.
That's what I'm afraid of.
They took you because you're immune to a plague that's wiping out the human race. They think you're worth sacrificing to find a cure.
They'll never stop until we can stop them.
The last city, Wicked's whole base of operations. It's the Lion's Den, hermano.
That's where we're going.
3 years we spent behind walls trying to break out. Now we're trying to break back in.
The Death Cure is a 2011 young adult dystopian science fiction novel by American writer James Dashner. It is the third installment in the Maze Runner series, but the fifth in chronological order because he wrote those two prequel novels that we don't care about.
Right. Are they prequels? I thought...
Yeah, I think they're prequels.
Didn't Steve or somebody say that some book was a... Never mind, it doesn't matter.
Well, they gotta be prequels if this one is the fifth chronologically.
I mean, well, obviously. I thought he said something about a book with Newt that came after, and so that... I don't know.
Maybe that was also a prequel?
I don't know.
Maybe. Critical reception for The Death Cure was mixed, which makes me feel really great.
That's fascinating, because I'm like 200 pages in, and I've enjoyed it much more than...
Oh, well, that's good.
The first two
You're
books.
Ahead of me, so I'm glad to hear that.
The first 15 chapters, I was like, it's the same thing again. But since they have gotten to Denver, for spoilers, it has gotten infinitely more interesting than any of the other. And it's not a high bar. I'm not saying it's like great, but I'm at least like, hey, this is different and something. So maybe the ending will suck. It's possible. I have no idea.
All right, well, so I do have some pull quotes and stuff. Common Sense Media gave the book 3 out of 5 stars, commenting that the book's oppressiveness kept it from being more memorable than they wanted it to be, whatever that means. This is straight from Wikipedia. Yeah. The Deseret News also commented on the book's bleak nature.
Okay, so I assume oppressiveness.
Yeah, probably dark.
Like dark and...
Yeah. But they praised it as being, quote, both conclusive and satisfying.
Okay.
The Horn Book Guide and Kirkus Reviews both gave positive reviews, with the Horn Book Guide saying that the book's conclusion was, quote, thought-provoking.
I could see that because I still don't know who I'm rooting for.
Interesting.
I still don't know, which I don't know if is necessarily a positive thing, but yeah. Especially for a series that I feel like is not written as has a... a writing level and style that is like more juvenile than a lot of the other summer series we've covered. I feel like I don't know. It doesn't feel as, but I guess I can see the ending being thought provoking, having not gotten there yet, because like I said, I still don't know who I'm rooting for, like All necessarily.
Right. Okay. And there was not a whole lot out there about this book specifically. So much like last time, we have some other random stuff that I thought was interesting as I was trying to find more fun facts about this book. The Wikipedia page for this book has a link to the original book trailer, which I wanted to watch, but it has been privated for some reason.
Okay. Interesting.
Not deleted.
Privated.
And then, again, this doesn't really have anything to do with The Death Cure specifically, but I found this on Dashner's old defunct Blogspot page, and I thought it was funny.
Okay.
In regards to all of the gladers being named after, like, famous scientists.
Yeah.
And he said, quote, who is Minho named after?
We asked that. We were like, oh, he must be named after, like, a Chinese or... I don't know if we know the ethnicity
hold on to your hat.
Minho. Okay.
Who is Minho named after? I get this question often, and the answer is simple. The events of The Maze Runner take place well in the future, so I purposefully wanted a main character who is named after someone who doesn't exist yet in our day. So keep an eye out for the great man who will rise up in our society called Mino. Translation, didn't know any Asian scientists, and I couldn't be bothered to Google 100%
it. 100% what it feels like. Yeah. It's like, I couldn't come up with anybody, which is insane because there's a ton of very famous inventors and stuff throughout history.
That's nuts.
Yeah.
And you couldn't just Google it, man?
Yeah.
Whatever. He stopped posting on that blog in May of 2012, and it is like a time machine. There's a post all about how excited he is for the Hobbit movies.
Oh, wonder how he felt about them.
We'll never know. We'll
never know. All right, that is it for the preview of the book. It's time now to learn a little bit about Maze Runner, The Death Cure, the film.
The world is dying. If we find a cure, that's the only way all this was worth it.
Do you regret it? What you did to us?
But I did what I thought was right.
There's no guarantee we make it back from this.
When we started this together, may as well end it that way too.
You still care about it, don't you?
Don't lie to me!
Come on.
How many kids do they have to round up, torture, kill? When the hell does it stop?
It stops when we find a cure. Thomas, you can save your friends. Or you can save us all.
Maze Runner, The Death Cure is a 2018 film directed by Wes Ball, the Maze Runner series, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, and The Legend of Zelda, who they just released the casting for the other
day. It's the upcoming
The upcoming live action Legend of Zelda movie they're making. They just released the Link and Zelda castings.
Right. Yeah, I heard about that.
Everybody's mad. It was written by T.S. Nolan, who wrote on all of the Maze Runner films, but is the sole writer of both the second and this one. Pacific Rim Uprising, The Adam Project, and other stuff. The film stars Dylan O'Brien, Kaya. I still haven't looked up how to pronounce her name. Kaya Scodelario, Thomas Brody Sangster, Natalie Emanuel, Giancarlo Esposito, Aidan Gillen, Walton Goggins, which is fun, Ki Hong Lee, Barry Pepper, Will Poulter, spoilers, and Patricia Clarkson. The film has a 43% on Rotten Tomatoes, a 50% on Metacritic, and a 6.3 out of 10 on IMDb. For comparison, the second movie had a 48% on Rotten Tomatoes, so lower on Rotten Tomatoes, but the second movie had a 43% on Metacritic, and this one has a 50%, so a higher Metacritic score. Identical scores on IMDb to the second movie, 6.3 out of 10 on both. And then going back to the first movie had a 66 on Rotten Tomatoes, a 57 on Metacritic, and a 6.8 out of 10 on IMDb. So the first one is still the highest rated across the board, but this one has a slightly better Metacritic score than the second movie.
Interesting.
But a slightly worse Rotten Tomatoes score. So make of that what we will. The film made $288 million against a budget of $62 million and was nominated for some Teen Choice Awards, including Choice Movie Ship for Thomas and Teresa.
No.
My parenthetical here says the children are lost. And now, to be fair, I don't think the children nominate those. I'd actually have no idea how the Teen Choice Awards work.
I don't either.
I assume, like, producer, you know, like, execs or whatever
like
come up with the, whatever
shit
they want to promote or whatever that year. Would be my guess, but yeah, I saw that. It didn't win, to be
fair. Team Brenda.
Didn't win, to be fair, but... So, principal photography for the film started in March 2016, roughly a year and a half after the second movie filmed. Not a lot on this, but this is, like, the big thing that everybody knows about, and it was everywhere. On March 18th, roughly 4 days after filming began, it was reported that Dylan O'Brien was hospitalized for injuries sustained while filming. Production was originally planned to only be delayed for around a month, month and a half, 2 months. But at the end of April, production was shut down indefinitely as it was revealed that O'Brien's injuries were more serious than originally kind of revealed or thought.
Ooh, yikes.
According to an article in The Hollywood Reporter that I found, which was the source for this on Wikipedia, O'Brien was on top of a vehicle wearing a harness and he was unexpectedly pulled off of the vehicle and hit by another vehicle.
Jesus Christ.
WorkSafe BC described his injuries as, quote, a concussion, facial fractures, and lacerations. IMDb Trivia also describing this event says specifically that he was drugged under the vehicle that he was harnessed to while filming the opening train chase sequence, which is a thing in the movie. apparently the take is used in the film. The take where he hurt himself is used in the film.
Nice.
It's apparently a moment where a car approaches a moving train and he jumps out of the window, I assume to like jump onto the train or something. Wes Ball, the director, asked O'Brien's permission to use the scene in the film, and O'Brien said he would be more heartbroken if it didn't make it into the cut. So,
Fair enough.
Honestly, if you're going to sacrifice, you know, your face for a movie, they might as well use the take.
Maybe he was hoping that it would become like the Lord of the Rings lore.
This is a take where he broke his face.
Yeah, where like every time
he fell under the car,
somebody's like, "Did you know?"
Got a concussion and broke his face. Yeah. Yeah, I read another, I think on IMDb it said like he broke like his occipital, like the bone around your eyes, basically both of them, I think.
Yikes.
And
that sounds rough.
And like his cheekbones or something, like he had like facial fractures and a concussion, and yeah, it was really, again, they had to stop filming for a year basically for him to recover. One other fun little IMDb trivia fact that I wanted to include here, because I think this is his only cameo. There's a scene where Teresa and Ava are presenting their data to board members at Wicked, I assume in a flashback, probably. Maybe not, I guess. I don't know. One member, the only one to not speak a word, who's a member, like a board member for Wicked, is none other than author of the book, James Dashner. So he has a cameo in this one. And getting into some reviews, Wikipedia did not have a summary of reviews, so I had to go to, I went to Rotten Tomatoes and pulled some choice blurbs from some of the reviews there. Chris Stuckman gave it a rotten rating. Chris Stuckman's a YouTube reviewer who I enjoy, generally speaking. He gave it a rotten rating, saying the things that really should have made Thomas change and evolve as a character feel like background elements at times. So I didn't think that the character moments worked all that well. Writing for NPR, Scott Tobias gave it a fresh rating, saying, quote, "The Maze Runner is the rare series that has improved with each installment, expanding beyond the organic pin of the first film into a bigger and more thrillingly realized science fiction sandbox," end quote. For The Atlantic, David Sims was not a fan, saying, quote, "The Death Cure is a grim, half-hearted farewell to this wave of young adult dystopias," end quote. The blurb for Peter Bradshaw's review for The Guardian was simply, "For fans only," and he gave it a 2 out of 5. And then finally, one positive review from the New York Times, Ben Kenigsberg, said, quote, "As silly as they sound, these movies are pretty well made, capable of outsized action and teary intimacy," end quote.
All right.
Which I think I've generally agreed with so far. The action scenes have been fun. They're pretty well made.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would say teary intimacy necessarily.
Like,
but
yeah, so far that has been my experience of the movies. They're not like amazing. They're not super memorable, but they're fun.
They're fine. Yeah, they're enjoyable enough. That is all I have. As always, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, not Threads right now, Blue Sky,
Goodreads.
That's another place. Interact. We'd love to hear what you have to say about all the stuff we talk about. Drop us a rating and a review on whatever podcast platform you listen to us, and support us at patreon.com/thisfilmislit. Katie, where can people watch Maze Runner, The Death Cure?
Well, as always, you can check with your local library. I have been getting all of the Blu-rays for this one from our local library. Mm-hmm. In order to get The Death Cure, I had to rent the 3 DVDs.
Yes, we have the anthology,
the 3 Blu-ray set. So yeah, we have all of them at the moment. Or if you still have a local video rental store, you can check with them. Otherwise, you can rent this for around $4 from Amazon, YouTube, Apple TV, or Fandango at Home.
Yeah, I am interested to see what this movie does, because I, like I said, I'm about 200 pages in, or a little over 200. I can't remember. I think I'm a little over 200 pages in, or right around there. And with where I'm at now, I'm actually wondering if the second movie was as much of a departure as it felt like at the time.
Yeah,
I have a suspicion, and we shall see in the movie. I may be completely wrong on this, but where I'm at in the book is that I think they just took a lot of elements from the third book.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of smushed them around into the second movie.
Yeah, that's what it's seeming like to me so far as well.
And I'm wondering if maybe this ultimately won't be quite as much of a difference than like it felt like, because it felt like they were going completely different places. But maybe not. We'll see. It also still may. I have no idea, obviously.
No way to know until we watch.
We will get there in 1 week's time, talking about The Death Cure. It may be a day later, so I'm gonna be out of town this weekend. Probably shouldn't be late, but if anything, it'll be like a day late, so look out for that. Until that time, guys, gals, non-binary pals, and everybody else,
keep reading books,
keep watching movies,
and keep being awesome.